don't know what love is until you know the meaning of the blues. Till you love the love you had to lose. You don't know what love is. Till you've kissed and had to pay the cost, until you flipped your heart and found you lost. You don't know what love is. You know
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek. I'm your host, along with Dennis Reimars, the WHFR News Director. So happy Friday the 13th, Dennis.
I don't think I'm on.
Oh, well, if you want to be talking on the air.
You know, yeah. I do. And we just talked about this. I don't put a lot of merit into the 13 and the bad luck and all that. Do you?
No, and I actually went to the definitive historical resource, which is Wikipedia, of course, and not necessarily verified by anyone who knows anything, remember?
Right.
But nonetheless, there's not much history in Friday the 13th on this day. Back in history, except for the 20th century, and it's one of those things that sometimes Fridays were thought to be bad luck in general for several hundred years by some people. And then the 13th, there's some, unfortunate thing. Like I think in the Scandinavian countries, the 13th person at the table is death.
It's like third on a match.
And if you have 12 people for dinner, you better put a plate for the 13th down. So it's bad luck if you don't have a place for death to sit down and eat.
All right.
Well, we have a special guest, and hopefully that the guest is calling in now, so hang in there. Hello, this is the WHFR Radio. Jay Koronek speaking. Hi, Richard. We were expecting your call. I'm going to put you on the air right now, so you have about another 25 minutes you can spend with us. Okay, hang in there, and we'll plug you in. Yep. Okay, here is Richard Greener, author of The Locator, fiction novel series, and just had a big debut of a TV show last night based on that. Richard, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Thank
Great.
You for having me.
Well, you have a fantastic fictional character you created for your first novel, I guess it was written or published in 2006, written for a couple of years before that, The Nolan Retribution. And the second novel continues this character whose nickname is The Locator. Last night, Fox TV debuted the first episode for the continuing series, called The Finder. And that was a pilot of the Bones series about 6-7 months ago. So congratulations on getting a TV show. You're the producer of the show now, actually, right?
Thank you very much. It's considering how all this began, this is almost inexplicable.
Well, it's a wonderful tribute. First of all, I should give you my background so you know where I'm coming from a little bit with this. My first master's degree was in comparative literature, so I read a lot of books, and I taught English composition in college full time for 14 years, and then I got into broadcasting and telecommunications, got a second master's degree, and we've been doing this college radio station here in the Detroit area since 1985. So it's great to have a non-commercial educational station and be able to have a variety of ideas that are not presented on commercial media. But let me just say, in the last couple of years, and I did retire from my full-time teaching job a couple of years ago, still around here at the station, I started reading mystery detective novels, just because I hadn't explored that genre before. You know how genres are not
sure.
Too highly regarded in college. You're sort of, it's too popular to be any good. And I have discovered some very good writers. Of course, since I always liked the Bones TV series, I went back and actually read the Kathy Reich's books. There's 14 of them now, I guess, in which Temperance Brennan is the lead, and impressed with her ability. But you've come up, and again, I'm not an extensive expert on the genre of mystery detective, but you have a character that, first of all, I can see why they decided to grab it for a television series. There's tremendous plot possibilities because this character, Walter Sherman, nicknamed The Locator or on TV The Finder, he's not a private detective officially. His expertise is not to find out who committed a murder, but to find a whole variety of things, anything, people, lost stuff. I think that's a tremendous concept. And I really enjoyed, I've only read your first novel, The Nolan Retribution. I really enjoyed it. It was exciting. There was plenty of adventure. I liked the fact that Walter Sherman was a somewhat older character. Was he perceived in his 50s, early 50s, late 40s, something like that?
In Nolan, yeah. Walter was in his mid-50s.
Yeah, yeah.
And in The Lacey Confession, which is the second book in the series, mm-hmm. he's 5 years older than that.
Oh, you actually age him. Okay, that doesn't always happen with these detectives. And I know Patricia Cornwell was talking about her Kay Scarpetta character, fictional character, who she's pretty much kept at the same age through 23 novels. So it all depends how you want to work that. But I think
In the third book, it's a prequel, and it goes back to 1994.
Oh, great!
So Walter is somewhat younger.
Okay. Folks, this is Richard Greener, again, this G-R-E-E-N-E-R, just like you might guess, who's the author of the Locator series and the originator of the idea, although technically not the creator of the TV series, The Finder. Maybe we'll just stay on this a little bit, and then we'll go backwards, because your life story of how you got here, and you're a senior citizen now, for Pete's sake, and it's been a long time coming. A lot of people they say famous novelists, they don't really publish when they're older. They have to be like in their 30s or something, or 20s, to get started. But so it's a wonderful tribute to you and an honor that that these books have caught on, and now the TV series. Tell us how that connection came about.
Career is I guess you would say it goes against the grain. Certainly my career as a writer, which was I never envisioned that I would even have such a career. I was actually in the broadcasting business for 30 years.
I knew that. Yes, and became on air talent too, as well as an executive in a black radio organization.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was a partner in at that time. This is over 30 years ago.
Right.
What was the country's largest minority owned broadcasting company. We owned
Great.
30 radio stations. Most of them were black program stations from coast to coast.
Did you have one in Detroit area?
Actually, for a while, we owned 102.7, which is not black.
But, no.
But most of our stations were the original black program stations in America. I for many years, ran... I was also the general manager of WAOK in Atlanta, which was Atlanta's leading black radio station for almost 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we owned WDIA in Memphis, which was the very first black station in America, and about 30 stations from coast to coast.
Well, we need that.
I retired from that business for health reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After I had my third heart attack.
Yep.
And I simply couldn't work anymore.
Yeah, the health issues certainly contributed to the career change, if you will, because and they were serious. They were heart related. And I should say that back in 86, when you were lucky enough to get a heart transplant, finally, after waiting, was it about 3 years or more?
In 2006, yeah.
In 2006, I'm sorry, 306, jeez, not quite there yet, I had a quad bypass. I had a heart incident, and all of a sudden they said, well, you could do this, you could do that, but what the heck, let's go in and just do the whole bypass. I'm not sure I really needed it, because I recovered like in 3.5 days, and I was back to work.
Oh, I'm sure they wouldn't have done
months,
it if you
so.
Didn't need it.
Oh, I don't know. Well, anyway, that's another story. But you have struggled with these congestive heart failure and other heart-related problems for 30-plus years. And
I was diagnosed with heart disease in my 20s, and I am the first male on my father's side of the family to get past 40.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
But, of course, I was born at the right time when all of these amazing developments have occurred in cardiology that were not available to my father or his father. Having been diagnosed in my 20s, I had just been promoted to a vice president of a national broadcasting company.
Mm-hmm.
My wife was pregnant with our first child, and I was determined not to let this interfere with my career or my family. I wasn't going to give up. I was going to fight it every inch of the way. And I persevered through 3 heart attacks and 2 surgeries. I had quadruple coronary bypass in my 30s.
Mm.
And I finally just ran out of luck at 45, and I had to retire. I didn't have any choice.
Well, it's an amazing story of personal struggle and determination, and it's just really amazing that that's the case. You know, it's really I'm so.
I never
such
considered
a
that
story.
There was an alternative, though.
Well, of course. Yeah, what is the alternative?
Yeah, the alternative is to say, oh, yeah. Okay, I give up, I suppose.
What I liked in reading your brief two-page bio that they gave me was the fact that not only your determination, but your wife, Maria, what a wonderful life partner.
I couldn't have done any of this without
her. She not only gave...
All the way back... to when we were just youngsters.
Right. Not only apparently giving you support along the way through these decades, but in terms of surviving the health problem, but also she was very, very significant in, arguing with the doctors to get the best treatment.
One of my heart attacks. I was taken literally off the street as an emergency patient and brought to a Catholic hospital here in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And when my wife arrived, there was a priest giving me last rites. And if you know my wife, that is not the thing that you want to do in front of her. And
wow.
She proceeded to basically wrap me up, take me out of that hospital. She rented an airplane and flew me to the best cardiologist in America, and I survived.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And then we might as well stay with this, and we'll come back to the writing and the TV series. But what I was amazed for too is that when in 2003, your heart condition had gotten to a point where you had to get a new heart. You had to hope for a heart transplant, and those aren't usually immediately available, and so you were on a waiting list. And that's when you began writing, but your daughters, and how many daughters do you have?
We have three.
It says
daughters and a son.
Says in the bio they started getting a phone calling campaign going for you. They started making calls to famous people, politicians, movie stars, whatever. And we've got a list here, and I can't give all of them. Bill Cosby, Jon Stewart of The Daily Show, Comedy Central, Clint Eastwood, Mel Brooks, the comedian, film star, Robin Williams, and even the academic and great political writer Noam Chomsky, who is not a household name, but and many, many more. And they started... What did they say when they called you?
It started out, of course, as a big surprise because nobody told me that they were going to do this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they all called just to wish me good luck as I was waiting for a heart, and just to offer me support. It was something that they didn't have to do, and in fact, when Robin Williams called, we were on the phone for about an hour,
huh?
And he wanted to know who else had called, and when I told him that I was probably the only person he'll ever speak to who received telephone calls from Jackie Mason and Noam Chomsky on the same morning,
right.
Robin Williams was amazed. He said, "You spoke
right.
to Noam Chomsky?"
Well, yeah.
He said, "I wish I could talk to Noam Chomsky."
Yeah, and some of our listeners may not know Jackie Mason, fantastic stand-up comic.
Yes.
He's done Broadway shows just with his humor alone. Sure, there's a Jewish context to his stories, but he's a masterful stand-up comedian, and not... You know, he hasn't appeared on TV too much recently. He's getting up there in years, too. But I'm just saying, an amazing comedian. Well, so you had about 3 months of these phone calls, and that must have...
I did. Every day, at least one person called, sometimes two or three. Barack Obama called me.
Oh, my goodness. Great.
A half a dozen senators called me, and it was something nice that they did that they didn't have to do.
Well, that's for sure. Now it.
And, of course, everybody was interested in what it was like to wait, to be on the waiting list.
Right.
Because when you're on the waiting list for a heart transplant, it's sort of like being under house arrest.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go anywhere because you never know when a heart is going to be available. So you have to be within 30 minutes of the hospital at all times.
Yeah.
So you're sitting stuck. I was stuck right here in my office with a pager, looking at it, waiting for it to go off, because there was only one place that had the number on that pager, and that meant that there would be a heart for me.
Now, if this is a certifiable treatment, we ought to get the names of these people and put them to work making more phone calls to other people. But I know it's just part of the larger family that kept you going, I think. And it's so wonderful your daughter's conceived of this and made that happen.
It was a great treat at the time, yes.
So getting back to the writing now, and we're talking to author Richard Greener, who has written two novels, and third, I guess, is on its way in the Locator series and the TV show's version of it called The Finder just debuted on Fox TV last night. And how did the transition happen from novel to TV?
Well, I had congestive heart failure while I was waiting for a heart, which means I couldn't really lie down. If you lie down, your lungs fill with fluid. Mm-hmm. So I did most of my sleeping sitting up, and even that was painful. So I did a lot of just sitting up in front of my computer, and eventually you get bored playing computer golf.
Yeah.
And
or
there
solitaire.
Are only so many newspapers that you can read online, and you know, without going nuts.
Yep.
And I just decided that I was going to write a novel. I can't explain why I decided to do that, but I just decided to do it. I'd never written anything before, but I knew that there were no rules for writing novels. I understand the conventions and the technicalities involved in writing plays and screenplays, and I freely admit that I can't do that.
Yeah.
But I knew that I couldn't make a mistake writing a novel. I could write a bad one, but I couldn't embarrass myself by doing it the wrong way. So I thought I had, in effect, an artistic license to do whatever I wanted to do. And since I was really, quite literally, living from day to day, I had no idea that I would live long enough to write the next chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I simply started writing at page one, and I kept going until I reached the end. And when I reached the end, I still didn't have a heart. So I started the second book with the same group of characters.
Well, let's keep going. Yeah, I got nothing else to do here in the office.
I wrote the second book, and I still didn't have a heart.
Uh-huh,
so
yeah.
I started the third book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about halfway into the third book when I finally got my transplant. And that's really where the story gets interesting, because most people recover from a heart transplant very quickly.
Yeah, let me just interrupt just for a second, and my apologies, but I should let you know, too, that Dearborn, Michigan, just west of Detroit, we're known as a somewhat senior community. The vast majority of our 100,000 residents are over the age of 50. We have a lot of senior apartment buildings that are owned by the city, and so besides myself, and I'm 66, had my heart problem and so on, I think there's a lot of people in our listening audience that can really really interested in this. So we'll just do a couple more minutes on this situation. Yeah, from what I read, again, it was not easy sailing after the transplant.
No, they couldn't close my chest after the operation. So they put me in a chemical coma, and it took 5 days for all the swelling to go down so that they could close and finish the operation. At which point, they tried to get me out of this chemically induced coma, only I didn't come out of it. Mm. And I stayed comatose for 38 days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I did wake up, I was paralyzed from the top of my neck down. I was quadriplegic.
Yeah.
I couldn't swallow, and I could not move any part of my body except to move my head from side to side.
That had to be even worse after all the years and all the other struggles and trials. But slowly you got better, I assume.
It took me about 2 years. The first 6 months were very difficult because I had a feeding tube, and I couldn't move. Mm-hmm. And I started to move after 6 months, and then I dedicated myself to rehabilitation, and for the next year and a half, I was in a wheelchair for a year, and and then for a few more years after that, I was in a walker. But I have completely rehabbed myself. It is somewhat miraculous to most doctors. It would take a trained medical professional to notice any lingering neurological difficulties that I have.
Well,
they appear to be perfectly normal.
That's so wonderful to hear about anyone.
And I have a 29-year-old heart.
So, yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Because
that's when your heart problems first started. And that's the 29-year-old person's heart that
very
you have.
Very interesting, yes. Yeah. Now, during this time, my books were published, and to say the least, I didn't have much interest in what was happening to them because I was too busy trying to stay alive and trying to get myself moving again. But I have wonderful agents, and one day I got a call from my agents in Hollywood, and they said that Fox was interested in my books, and here we are about 2 years later, and there's a show on television based on the characters in my book.
Yeah,
if you've read Kathy Reich's books, you know that the characters in her book don't exactly correspond to the characters that are on television.
I had an experience. I'm sorry again. I apologize. We don't have a squelch control, so our listeners know that I just cut you off. But I actually met Hart Hansen and Kathy Reichs at the Austin Film Fest, which is sort of a screenwriters conference, too, last October. And, yeah, Kathy said, I've just sort of, adjusted to the fact that this is a younger, different version of Temperance Brennan, and it's not my character, and we're good to go. There always has to be adaptation and changes with the characters. But Hart Hansen apparently was looking for another story idea. He couldn't think of another series. Often they ask successful showrunners, as they call them, series creators, to come up with something else, and he read this. And I have to say, too, if I didn't already commend you on your writing style, it reads as good or better than most of the other so-called popular mystery detective writers. I'm talking about literary style and organization. I've actually been lucky enough, even on a teacher's salary, to visit St. John, where Walter Sherman's base is in the novels, and several of the other locales that you talk about, northern New Mexico. It's so accurate. It's so real. You make it extremely, and I guess that's one of the thrills of detective mystery writing. You have to be very descriptive and good, as well as making a few important social points along the way, too, is that Walter Sherman does have issues and ideas. For example, there's a pretty harsh critique of the fast food industry or the meat processing industry in Nolan Retribution 2, of course. And I guess it was on. Had you read Fast Food Nation? That was in 2002.
I was aware of that, but originally I had thought of doing it with a medical theme.
Oh yeah, wow.
And I decided that wouldn't work because there were so many changes coming in healthcare that it might be outdated, and so I went to E. coli, which most people don't realize that the E. coli virus was only discovered in 1982.
Hmm.
It's we really don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to fear that somebody was going to find a solution to E. coli poisoning before my book came out.
Well, it's still a relevant issue today, very relevant, in fact. And I like to see those touches. I like to see the characters myself just in reading about, I love great literary style and great description and interesting characters, but I also like them involved in social issues, too, to a certain extent, and not detracting, hopefully, from the larger plot.
Well, Walter, while Walter doesn't have any stated politics, I think if you read it, you realize that he is a rather classic outsider. He lives off the grid. He stopped paying his taxes when he was in his 20s. Nobody really knows who he is. He's referred to as a phantom, and that sort of outsider personality does have a political tinge to it. Of course, in the Lacey confession, I solved the JFK assassination. In fact, the Spanish translation is sold as under the title of JFK La Confession.
Okay, it's on my list now. Next book I'm going to try to read, and both of these are in paperback
now. The third
now
book, which is not published yet, solves the 18.5-minute gap on the Nixon tape.
Well, thank you. That's about time.
Walter is hired to find there is someone who has the tape without the erasure, and Walter is hired to find that person, and of course he does.
What about finally here, I guess? I mean, we've covered amazing facets of your life and got you up to this point. But for the TV show, Hart Hansen is listed, and appropriately, I think so, give him the blame here, as the creator of the Finder series. But it's based on your books, and they give you credit for that. And you're an ongoing producer, probably like Kathy Reichs is an ongoing producer of Bones. Does he let you at least see the script and offer comments if you want to of those episodes?
Yes, and Hart has been just wonderful, and I'm very happy with what he's doing with these characters, and we both recognize that the TV characters belong to him, and the books belong to me, that's a good division as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I have in the course of my telecom teaching career, about 20, 30 years, gone to many conferences and talked to many writers of film and TV stories and showrunners like Hart Hansen. And he's one of the nicest people to meet and to talk to, at least in that context anyway. And the other people that were there with him, including David Boreanaz and Kathy Reichs, also spoke. Of course, he's still providing money for them. But they spoke very favorably about how he handles his stories. He's the man. He's an executive producer. He's in charge of still Bones, although he's spending most of his time with the Finder now, apparently, writing the scripts for that and himself and so on. But really one of the really special people who can work with people and respect people, even though, sure, the buck stops there. He's the final creative decision maker, and I think, you know, there has to be one finally for these things. And TV is so tough. How do you get a good, complete story in an hour with all those time segments? And he's a master at it, has been proven by the Bones series, I think. Although Walter Sherman,
there is a magic to writing a 43-minute script, and then you throw in 15 or 16 minutes of commercials, and find a way to interest 8 to 10 million people, so that they stay attached to it and watch. It's beyond my capacity, that's for sure.
Well, and there's a lot of changes. People read it, and there's a lot of differences. Walter Sherman is younger in the TV series, obviously. His group of followers is a little different. He's not based in St. John, the U.S. Virgin Islands. He's in Florida. You can, if you think about it, it gives more plot possibilities. And I don't know. The only thing I realized was that the Walter Sherman character on TV, he has his special finding ability. It's almost an obsession, but it was caused by a war accident in the Iraq War, and that so it's like he has a tragic flaw or something he might die from, even if he doesn't get an operation, they've said. And your Walter Sherman has just always had a special knack for that. I mean, he's not in danger of dying from it.
That's a major difference. Convention has been, that's entirely Hart Hansen's idea.
Right.
And I understand why they did it.
Sure.
And
I
have no problem with it. I hope that the success of the TV show leads more people to my books, where they will find my Walter in my context.
I hope so, too. I think it's happened, of course, with Kathy Reichs, and it's happened others for some others, too, who have been involved with TV, not necessarily involved with movies. That doesn't necessarily help, but I'm sure it will. And I highly recommend your first novel, because I've read it, and I don't doubt the second and third novels are going to be equally fun for me. And again, I'm a literature professor who doesn't normally dabble in popular literature, but you've done a great job there, and
thank you very much.
Your entire story, I hope, has buoyed the hopes and of our audience in terms of facing adversity.
I would say, and I think it's important. I think that what I've managed to do is extraordinary. but I don't think that I'm extraordinary. I think that under the same circumstances, everyone has the capacity to make the same decisions that I made and to react in the same way.
I certainly hope so. Have to toss a zinger question at the end. Obviously, you had the resources to to get the health care you needed, either because you were able to afford a great health insurance policy or because you had saved some money up from your broadcasting executive position. Do you think everybody should have access to health care, like universal single-payer health care? How do you feel about that?
I favor single-payer universal health care. My wife is Dutch. We spend a lot of our time in Europe, and particularly in Holland. And the European health care system, which is greatly misunderstood by most Americans, is a far superior model than the one that we have. I am exposed on a daily basis to people who literally die waiting for organ transplants because there aren't enough organs, or especially people who never even get on a waiting list because they can't afford it. They have no means to pay for it. And that sort of situation is simply unheard of in Western Europe.
Yeah, I've been mentioning that and suggesting to our listeners in this show, we do alternative ideas just to keep the discussions going, that still is something that everybody should look at very closely, try to read some books about it, because we're not there yet. Obamacare is not really the answer. It was a compromise, and some people may call it, ooh, socialism, but there's a lot of socialism that's actually
really good. Well, I don't see how it can be
really
socialism to require by law 30 million people to buy somebody's private health insurance.
I don't like that concept either, and I think it's just probably that was a compromise with the Republicans to try to continue support for the private insurance companies so they don't lose
any
business.
We ought to have a rational and adult conversation in America about what it is that we expect our society to be responsible for. Mm-hmm. And then having decided what those things are, then we fund them.
Yeah.
And we don't operate that way.
Yeah.
Not now.
I know. And I don't want to take up more of your time. Get back to writing or enjoying the positive reviews of the Finder and your books because you deserve that recognition. Stay healthy. You know how to do it, obviously.
Well, thank you so much. I'm 70 years old now, and I'm actually in better shape than I've been in 40 years.
Well, it's about time to enjoy every minute. Thank you for calling into the WHFR Journal, and good luck to you, and as I said, stay healthy.
Thank you again.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Wow. Dennis, what do you think of Richard Greener?
Man, and I have to tell you, nice job. I had a short list of questions, and you covered everything and very smoothly. Just an amazing guy.
Mm-hmm.
Down to earth, so grounded. And I think that what he's been through, is that creates a degree of humility, doesn't it?
Well, as he said, it's not that anybody can write a novel, but I mean, a lot of people would just give up. But I think at least if they had the health insurance or the resources, it still took the power of his wife and his daughters to keep good things happening for him, besides his own personal perseverance.
That had nothing to do with health insurance.
Yeah.
You're right. You're exactly what they did.
I can understand when I went in for my health operation, my heart operation, you want to stay alive. I mean, there's a great, motivating factor there. And although recovery, extended recovery, as a paraplegic for months, too, after his heart transplant, it's got to be depressing.
Yeah.
And yet, you keep going, and he had that wonderful support system there, too.
38 days in a coma will change your life, won't it?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have to finally say a little critique, not to bring anybody down, about the Finder series. The first episode last night was different than the pilot.
Okay.
They had changed some things around, but they tried to push all kinds of information in there about who were these characters that if you saw the pilot, you didn't need to know that. I mean, even though they had some new characters introduced and a couple changes in the main characters. And so it was a very busy, crowded episode. And as one or two professional critics online have said this morning, they hope it sort of just gets down to a single plot, and that the characters, once established, can just do their thing and interact more, and you can get into the characters more. It was a very, very busy hour, and maybe some people would find it just a little too much. Do you like the tragic flaw of his, maybe, you know, because of his head injury, he's got this almost supernatural power. Even use the word supernatural power.
Right.
I like the Walter Schirmer in the novels because he just has an aptitude for it.
Right, right.
But he's smart. He knows how to do research. It doesn't just come to him in a dream or something in the novels. He knows contacts. He knows people. And he finds stuff out. And, of course, he's got the wherewithal after being successful at being at locating things and people to have saved up some money. So he can fly places. He can call people. He can buy stuff, you know, to help his exploration. So the novels are very full, but he doesn't really have a tragic flaw other than he is that outsider. You know?
And does he charge money based on what he's looking for? I mean, obviously he gets
big amounts of money, just like the TV series, because he's not a PI, because he doesn't do taxes, he has no official business organization, so he can give a high level of privacy to his clients, you know, beyond any sort of official notice, and so he gets some of the most, some of the biggest cases that way. It's a great premise for a novel, and you're not dependent, like the Bones series, on always having bones at the beginning, a dead body. You know, you don't need that with the locator, because he could be looking for a watch, he could be looking, but it could have tremendous significance, or the 18 minutes of lost information from the Nixon tape there. So I hope the series goes well. I mean, all the characters, Jeff Stultz, not a great, easy to remember name, but he's the actor who plays Walter Schirmer on TV. Born in Detroit, there you go, Michigan connection. And in a couple of interviews this week that he did to help promote the beginning of the series, he mentioned he's from Detroit.
Good,
even though apparently he was really raised in California. But you know, he mentions Detroit all the time. Must have had some significance. Maybe he listened to a lot of Motown music or something.
Maybe we're hip again. Maybe being from Detroit is the in thing.
I hope so. That'd be nice to know.
Yeah.
Let's listen to Jim Hightower and come back with, we have a number of important local Dearborn stories to cover before the end of our hour. And I just want to also thank Richard Greener again for that great extended interview about his life, how he got into writing, and how he got this TV connection now, and how he is continuing a very, very successful career as a writer. Okay. Jim Hightower, tell us how to stimulate consumer spending. Is that the way we get out of this economy? I would think, Dennis, my guess is here that you have to have money to spend money.
Yeah, that's always been the little catch.
Let's see what he says. So perk up your ears. We'll be back in just a couple minutes right after Jim Hightower's commentary.
Bars can get in legal trouble when they overserve patrons who then get a DUI citation. But what about retail outfits that contribute to SUI, shopping under the influence? Luxury stores, art galleries, and such have long used booze to stimulate sales. They pour free wine and other libations for their high-end customers, hoping that a lubricated shopper will be less guarded and more willing to reach for that platinum card. But the New York Times reports that the tactic of getting shoppers buzzed has now gone mass market, especially among online retailers. As one of them gleefully put it, post-bar, inhibitions can be impacted, and that can cause shopping and hopefully healthy impulse buying. Great. Our society has advanced from alcohol-induced sex to alcohol-induced consumerism. In either case, the morning after can be a downer. Take the guy who quaffed a tub of beer one night. He stumbled home in a stupor and, stupidly, went online. When he awoke, he learned that he had bought a $10,000 motorcycle tour of New Zealand. Internet retailers say there's been a boom in night traffic. Ask if boozy buying splurges might be sparking the increase? An eBay executive exclaimed, "Absolutely!" Noting that eBay's busiest sales period in every time zone is 6:30 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. He happily summed up the reason for this. When people get home from work in the evening, it's decompression time. The consumer's in a good mood. This is Jim Hightower saying, Barack Obama should jump on this. We're told that to get America's economy moving again, consumers need to buy more stuff. Forget trying to pass a stimulus package or a jobs program. To stimulate, inebriate. Just send everyone a credit card, a book of drink coupons, and a list of late-night online marketers.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Well, it's not starting now, but what is that music? That is the lead-in music for Highway 61.
All right.
Today, Joanne Korchinska returns from California.
That was a little teaser, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Get you in the mood for the best in blues for 4 hours. Joanne will be here on Friday the 13th, and that won't keep anyone away. I just want to say, too, there's really no historical basis for, I mean, you can always look back and find something disagreeable that happened on a Friday the 13th, but that's just coincidence, folks. I have personally, in my 66 years, always had really good days on Friday the 13th, and knock on wood. Okay, hey, I'm sorry.
I still have to ask you, when they make elevators now, do they have, or I'm sorry, do they, when they have elevators in buildings, do they still not include the 13th floor on the elevator because it's unlucky? Have you, I mean, you know
yes,
what I'm talking about.
Absolutely, hotels.
Yeah, hotels.
Typically, if they're taller than 13 floors, they don't have a 13th floor.
And that, again, goes to space completely and superstition, right?
Well, you know, because some people just say, oh, I'd rather not be on the 13th floor. You know, it's okay to be the 14th floor, geez. But it's just no historical basis on why that should be superstitious, especially. Other than, yeah, some people don't like Fridays, some people don't like Tuesdays, and like in France. And the number 13, as we pointed out earlier, is somewhat weird, but so don't freak out. It is true, actually, that that in some cases they've shown that on Friday the 13th there's fewer admissions to hospitals.
Okay,
you know, for people needing medical care, there's fewer accidents, fewer. But that's, they say, because some people are already scared, so they don't go anywhere.
Well,
so nothing can happen if you don't go anywhere or do anything.
Right.
And don't be that way, folks. Okay. Sure. Stuff could happen anytime, any day, as long as you're somewhat careful and, you know, do the best you can. Don't hold back from living your life fully. And just, you know.
What did my mom say? Everything in moderation. And, mm-hmm. and whatever you're going to do today, don't do it until 15 more minutes when we're done.
Yeah, right. Okay, shifting to local news and alternative views. Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday indicates that the state of Michigan has approved a $7.5 million loan for Dearborn to help complete the next stage of their combined sewer overflow project. The sewer system in Dearborn, which the big project started maybe 10, 12 years ago now, is going to continue, it looks like, for another 15 or 20 years. Its total cost will be more than $350 million when you finally add it up, because costs keep going up all the time.
Oh,
and construction costs keep going up. So I'm sure the dollar value will be higher than what they originally thought, too. And I'm happy that Mayor O'Reilly has turned the direction around about 5 years ago, in that the money we're spending now is also being used to improve the infrastructure of sewer systems. Previously, it was just going to handle the nasty extra runoff,
right,
during big downpours or whatever, when the sewer systems would overflow. And what they're doing now in many places in Dearborn, there's a few of these retainers that have been built. But now they're actually going in and putting two systems in place. In other words, they're taking out the old sewer systems, which would have to be replaced sometime anyway, putting in new systems, and then putting, like, right next to them, the overflow. So, in other words, our money is being spent not just on the overflow, but actually to improve and renew, replacing with brand new, the old sewer system, which was going to go anyway, and they had to dig into the street and tear it up but just to replace that. So we're actually getting two for one here, even though the cost is massive. It's no more, not really any more expensive, as I understand it, than just doing the sewer overflow project, which they couldn't really do the way it was originally conceived anyway, which was, I won't go into that.
That was unfortunate they found that out halfway through. But you're right, doing it now in today's dollars saves a heck of a lot of money from doing it later.
Of course, the criticisms on Patch.com blog and Press and Guide is that from local people like you, loyal listeners, hey, it's only a loan. okay, we got to pay 2.5% as well as the principal back. So it looks like we ran a little short in our collected balances. I mean, people are paying extra money on their water bills to pay for this over the next 9 million years. But
it's a little bit less than that.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
Okay. But apparently they needed more cash up front, or they wouldn't have taken the loan, because the loan you have to pay back the amount, $7.5 million, plus pay 2.5%. And I don't know, that's cheaper than most mortgages these days, but it's a lot of money. Still when you start with $7.5 million. And I don't know how many, can't remember, because I don't have the article open right now, how many years they get to pay that back. But it's kind of nice, because we've got to keep that moving forward, get it done. You know, can't take forever on this, although it looks like the total completion is going to take another 10 or 15 years.
Seriously?
From what I've read already.
Okay,
yes.
What I've read didn't give a definite time frame.
Well,
so
that's what I think I've read in the past. It's not going to be over with quick. This is not going to finish it up.
No.
Whoop-de-doo. The other loan that didn't happen in this case is the federal government has halted and may not even start up again, the application for $730 million loan to Severstal. Now, Severstal is in Dearborn. It is making steel, and it's been pretty successful at making steel in the U.S. market. However, it's owned by a Russian company. So any profits they make, some may go back into the establishment in Dearborn and add jobs, but basically go back to Russia, to their owners who are Russian. And from what I've read in places, the loan was halted, and I think it's politics. This is how I read between the lines here.
Well, that's how Mayor O'Reilly said, too.
Yeah, because Barack Obama doesn't necessarily want the Republicans and or the Tea Partiers to criticize the fact that it would look like, on the surface, superficially, almost $750 million are going to a Russian company. And let's help our U.S. companies. Why give that big? It's a loan, folks.
It's also a loan again.
So they'd have to pay it back with interest. So it's not, you know, it's not just money. They're not just giving the money to the Russian company. And it will help them with expansion faster than they intended, also producing and taking away some of our need to buy steel from China.
Right.
And from other countries. So it is made in U.S. steel that should be cheaper and help with U.S. jobs.
200 jobs, more than 200 jobs.
Compared to buying our steel from overseas and having to pay those prices when we do need steel. So I think it's unfortunate that it didn't happen. Maybe you do believe that the federal government shouldn't give money to anybody. and that's an interesting point of view, and I can understand that in some cases. But I don't really see how this would have too many downsides to it. If you look at the whole story, if you look at all the complete facts, it looks like this would be a win-win for job creation in America, for steel production in America. One blogger did say, hey, if they're succeeding so well, why don't they pay for their own upgrades? An interesting question.
It is an interesting question.
Just think, like, with that $7.5 million for the city of Dearborn, but remember, this is $730 million for Severstal. A little difference there, times 10,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
That, obviously, that's the 100. Upgrades will happen faster. So we can be more competitive in the U.S. with steel production, even though it's a Russian-owned plant, and put more jobs here in the U.S., in Dearborn, in fact, faster. Okay, so, you know, I don't know how you see that, but I think politically Obama didn't want another bit of ammunition given to some of the Republican nominees who are still debating, what, a couple times a week, getting all that press coverage for months more, as well as, of course, now the primaries have started.
Well, and you hits on something key. They have to pay this back. The only way we can really lose is if they don't.
Right.
Because it's a business arrangement.
But they seem to have a good business plan, so I don't see that wouldn't be the issue here. It's just that, and even Obama administration, he's been dissed by the Russian president and in a couple of trade talks and other issues recently. Not very pleasant. So he may actually have it's not the Republicans. It may be he just have a temporary grudge about doing anything to help any Russians, whether it's the Russian leader or Russian business people or whatever. So it's just tit for tat with politics, you know. And
I think you go back a little further and you look at the record. Severstal bought this in 2004 after Rouge Steel went bankrupt, and they kept the majority of the employees that were already there. I mean, that right there is a really good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you look? Whatever.
Yeah,
you're right.
I think so too. Well, they did have some accidents, and they did have some
absolutely
disasters, if you will, too. Fires, a couple of people dying, but it looks like investigations didn't show that the company was not necessarily negligent. And making steel, my dad was a steel worker when he was a young person many, many years ago at the Rouge steel plants, and dangerous, terribly dangerous job. I mean, you know, we're talking about molten metal. It's like a volcano inside the factory.
Absolutely.
And I know they have higher tech now than they did then, but it's still very, very dangerous situation, and accidents will happen in anything. And in that situation, it's going to be even more consequential. Before we leave, we only have 7 minutes before Highway 61 is to start with Joanne today for 4 hours and hear all of her stories about California blues. I bet she went to a few blues clubs.
Oh, she
out there,
had to, so man.
We'll find out. The Detroit Auto Show starts tomorrow.
And
WHFR, in honor of that, it's our automobile theme week that starts Sunday. Just because we always start our theme weeks on Sunday, they go to Saturday. Don't ask me why. Is because the calendar starts on Sunday?
It does, sure.
Some calendars start on Sunday. And so we'll be playing music all throughout the week in a variety of formats that has something to do with automobiles or driving or cars or travel or revving up your engine or something, you know.
We may reach out
and it'll be fun. It'll be great fun. If you wonder why all this car stuff is happening, this is how we're doing it, with alternative music in a wide variety of formats. In fact, we got some nice comments from people about our 2 days of special alternative holiday music. And this was Christmas Eve Day and Christmas Eve that we pre-recorded very special shows, worked very hard. And people said, I didn't know there was so many different original songs in so many different musical formats having to do with Christmas and the holidays. And, it was cool because people were listening because, wow, I never heard that before. They might have heard 3 months of all the traditional Christmas music from the pop artists. But they come to WHFR, you're here because we do things differently. And we let you know, we let you in on stuff that other people don't make available. And we hope it improves your life and gives you more fun and excitement and interest and all that. So the auto show starts tomorrow. Dennis, hours and prices throughout they're going to be doing 2 weekends and, right, of course, next week.
So it's Saturday.
So it's 9 days.
Saturday tomorrow to Saturday the 21st.
Oh, just Saturday. Okay.
And then, well, actually, those I'm going to 9 to 10.
Okay.
And then on Sunday the 22nd, it'll be 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. As you said, the ticket price, $12 for adults. And if you want to get them online as an e-ticket, it's still $12. Seniors, those 65 and older.
I love this. Last year I discovered it. I turned 65. If you're 65 or older and can prove it.
$6.
$6. Half price. That's worth it. Because remember, parking is going to cost you something down there.
Absolutely.
That is my criticism every year. I almost don't go down every year, and yet I always wind up due. Parking is a bear. I can use a different B-type word for it, but
I like your
it's
choice.
Clean. Parking is ridiculous, and it's for an auto show. You can't find a place to park. You have to wait in lines for hours to go up to the roof parking of Cobo.
It's not as
or
fun
even
as
the
sounds.
Other even the other indoor parking facilities. 30 minutes waiting on the street to even get in the place. I mean, it's crazy, and it's not close by. You know, it's like a walk in the cold. You say, "Oh, you can walk over that overpass." That's not heated. That overpass from one of the parking streets—it's freezing cold in there. Okay, you don't have the wind, but trust me, if you're not in good shape, you cannot easily get from the parking lot to Cobo Hall without freezing. Okay, or being totally exhausted. So maybe if you're in a wheelchair, somebody can push it for you. But it's up and down stairs, and I guess there's some elevators in some of those parking structures. But believe me, huge crowds, and they deserve it. But it's a car-related thing. In Detroit, we don't have decent parking facilities for these big events when they happen. It's a struggle to park and to walk to Cobo. But fine when you get there. So hope you enjoy yourselves. If you can go down, and it's sort of a tradition, since my dad worked at Chrysler Corporation as a job setter on the assembly line for DeSoto originally, and then at Chrysler Trenton. For all those years, it was always a family tradition for us to go down. So I try to continue that, remembering my parents who are no longer around to be part of that anymore, except they're always, of course, in my thoughts. We're going to have our auto theme show next week. And next Friday on the Journal, we're going to have a special interview. And it's a secret right now with a big-time automobile magazine person. Oh, boy.
Yes, we are. And it's a secret. And
yes,
it's a secret because they haven't confirmed.
It's a secret to us, too, yes.
I just wanted to finish up. Children are $6 as well, and that's 7 to 12 years old. So if your children are under 6, bring them because it's free. Mm-hmm. And you can purchase tickets at the door right at the Cobo Center Concourse with cash, and there will be some ticket kiosks set up for credit card purchasing.
Yeah.
There you go.
So it's, again, at private event, private profit event. We're not doing a commercial for that
Absolutely
necessarily,
not.
But it's part of Detroit tradition. Even though they renamed it and took the name Detroit out of it, it's North American International Auto Show. New York Auto Show is still called New York. The L.A. Auto Show is still called L.A.
Right.
But, well.
Maybe because we're that big of a deal.
Well, we were starting to be the number one, and then tough times and American car manufacturers weren't quite keeping up. And so, but they did the name thinking that, well, we're going to be the best. And we're not the best show. It's not the most concept cars, not the most new introductions here. And they're spread out all over the planet now at auto shows, from Tokyo to Paris to London and so on, and New York and LA, of course. It's not the big deal it used to be, but it's still very important. And people come from all over the region, if not the world, to be part of this and to see what's going on here. So am I endorsing buying an automobile? Of course, sensibly, and we'll talk about that next Friday. There's some great options in terms of powertrains. There's some great new economy cars being introduced, even like the Chrysler Dodge Dart, which, much better gas economy. If you have the wherewithal to buy a new car, it's great. Now, a couple of things have happened. And I guess I'll do this one as we're waiting for Joanne to come. It's WHFR Dearborn, folks. Yep. So before the blues, it's pretty icy out there, and Joanne has to be careful with her walking. And so she's taking care as she's coming in. And she actually was concerned about Friday the 13th, too.
Was she really?
Worried about that. She'll be here in a moment. Big announcement today via dearborn.patch.com. Website. No additional pools will close in 2012, according to Mayor O'Reilly. Of course, that's his proposal. What's going to happen is if they don't come up a way for paying for it in the future, there'll only be two pools in Dearborn in 2013.
Right.
So they are going to close, folks. It's going to happen unless we find a way to pay for it. And what they're suggesting is, as I read this, and it's a pretty good story on
patch.com, really good story,
it goes into some detail here. Just like they have special assessment districts for East Dearborn and West Dearborn, where the businesses pay extra taxes for services that benefit mainly them.
Sure.
They're suggesting SAD, bad acronym, but
right,
SAD,
right, right,
special
right.
assessment districts, for the people around the pool areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that these homeowners would pay extra money in their taxes each year to help support the pool. Well, that's the question. The question is, should everybody in that area, whether they use the pools or not, because the pools are close,
right.
so they're nearby, pay some of the cost to keep the pools going, or should they just raise the cost on the users?
Right.
Okay? And that's the only two ways that are being proposed now. The city is apparently not going to pony up from the general fund money enough to pay for anything more than two pools. That's at least it seems to be the mayor's position.
Right.
I don't know how the council stands, member by member on that situation.
And that's important. You just said this is a proposal by the mayor. This is
right. just a proposal.
Just nobody said anything.
The people in charge of Save Our Pools, Ryan Woods is the leader of that. That's
right.
his name, Ryan Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And they're participating in talks with the city and budget talks in December and January among the administration, too. Have given three options: fundraising, grants or special assessment districts, or